One of the main reasons of this conflict in Ukraine was to weaken Russia, particularly weaken Vladimir Putin. Considering what has happened in Russia recently, the presidential election in Russia, has the West achieved its goal in Russia?
Not even close. In fact, it's the opposite. Everything about what the West has done in regards to Ukraine has strengthened Russia, strengthened Russia as a nation, and strengthened Vladimir Putin as the Russian leader. Putin was always going to win this election. It didn't matter who they put. There's these fantasy that if Alexei Navalny had run against Putin, or if Boris Nemtsov hadn't been killed, Nemtsov would never have gotten more than 7% of the vote, and Navalny would never have gotten more than 2% of the vote. These aren't viable opponents. There is no viable opponent to Vladimir Putin. He's just a good leader. He has done great things as a Russian leader. So, why wouldn't the Russian people re-elect him to office? But it wasn't just about Putin. It was also a vote in confidence of the Russian nation, the state of the nation, so to speak, and the future of the nation. In 2020, the United States held a presidential election that captured the attention of many Americans, and record numbers of voters went out there. They said that Donald Trump got the second largest number of votes for president in the history of the United States. The only person to beat him was Joe Biden, who got a few million more votes. And so you're like, wow, that means that the American people are engaged in everything. 66% of the population of the eligible voters participated in that. 77% of Russia's eligible voters participated. Now, if it was just, oh, Putin, we have no other choice. Oh, it's a dictatorship. Oh, the oligarchs and the autocrats will decide who's going to lead. We're not we the people have no say. You would have had under 50% of the population show up for the vote. 77% of the Russian eligible electorate showed up to vote, which means that the Russian people said, "We believe in this. This is what we believe in." And one of the reasons why they believe in it is, of course, because of the success of the last quarter century that they've been led by Vladimir Putin out of the abyss of the 1990s, but also that because of this Ukraine conflict, last summer, Russia passed a new foreign policy that was predicated on the notion that Russia was a great civilization on par with any other civilization in the world. Prior to that, the Russian people had been prone to saying, "Oh, we're an inferior nation, inferior to the West," and that's why all these, Navalny types were looking to the West because they lacked confidence in who they were as Russians. Today, the Russians are very confident in who they are and very comfortable with who they are. They like who they are. And so you have this new foreign policy that is predicated on Russia is a civilization on par with all the great civilizations of the world, and that this great civilization will never subordinate its interests to any other nation or group of nations. There will be no more kneeling before the West. Russia will stand in front of the West. This is the Russia that the Russian people believe in, and this is the Russia that the Russian people went out and voted for. It wasn't just a vote for Putin. It was a vote for Russia. They were participating in a process that they firmly believed would lead them down a better path or continue down this good path. And it's an absolute failure of policy on the part of the United States and the West, because not only has what they've done backfired, but it's strengthened Russia.
I talked with Paul Carrick Roberts. He was criticizing Putin's attitude toward this war since this war started. He said he's so patient. He's letting everything to escalate. If they send these Taurus missiles to Ukraine and they hit the Kerch Bridge, they hit Crimea, what would be the reactions on the part of Russians? Are they going to sit in back and be patient and just going along with this escalation?
Let's put it this way, with all due respect to Mr. Roberts, he doesn't know anything about the military. He doesn't know anything about war. Nothing. I would like to remind him that Russia's winning this war. Does he want Russia to lose this war? Because he's basically criticizing a winning policy posture. He wants Russia to lose this war because if Russia I'd like to introduce him to the concept called the OODA loop. It's derived from John Boyd, an American fighter pilot. The Marine Corps adopted it in the 1980s to get us focused on maneuver warfare, how to maximize your potential. And you do this through the OODA loop, which is observe, orient, or orient, observe, decide, act. Basically, you orient yourself on the problem, you observe it. From that observation, you make a decision to act. And then you start all over again. Once you act, you see how the enemy reacts, observe, reorient, make a decision, and then do it. And then the enemy has to react to you. If you get inside the enemy's decision-making cycle, you're in control. And so for Mr. Roberts, who has no knowledge of this, or at least he has no concept of how it's applied, he wants Russia to let NATO and Ukraine initiate the OODA loop so that Russia's reacting to them. And once you start reacting, they're inside your decision-making loop and they're going to beat you. Russia isn't playing that game. Russia is in charge. Everybody's reacting to Russia. Russia's not reacting to them. And that's why Russia's winning. You know, hitting the Kerch Bridge. Would it be the first time the Kerch Bridge was blown up? Nope. Be the third time. What did Russia do the other two times? Throw a temper tantrum? React? Overreact? No. Patience. Because Russia has a strategic vision. Russia has a game plan. Russia's winning. Russia's winning. Russia's winning. For all the people that criticize the patience of Putin, you're just proving how stupid you are, how ignorant you are, and have no idea of why and how Russia is winning this war. You think you could do it better, but you can't. Russia's winning this war because of it's not the patience of Putin, it's because Putin has confidence in the strategic vision and how they're implementing it, and he's not going to let Ukraine and NATO get him to deviate from that. And how do you deviate from that? By doing what they want you to do. By overreacting to a provocation.
Jake Sullivan is trying to convince Ukrainians that the Russia's objective was to wipe Ukraine off the map. Russia has already failed in all its objectives. And the other objective, in his opinion, was to crush the democratically elected president of Ukraine. How much of these things that Jake Sullivan is putting out were the Russian objectives since this conflict started?
Well, we know for a fact that, Jake Sullivan's wrong. Because the Istanbul communique, which represents the negotiations that took place between Ukraine and Russia in the immediate aftermath of the initiation of the special military operation, proves that Russia's goals were not territorial acquisition. Russia, of course, would keep Crimea, but Russia, reconquered or reabsorbed Crimea in 2014. It wasn't part of this current conflict. Russia also said that the Donbass would be the independent status of the Donbass would be recognized pending some sort of referendum that would decide which way the Donbass went, but it wasn't about automatically absorbing it. And we know, the Minsk Accords from 2014 to 2022, the Donbass had wanted to be absorbed by Russia, but Russia wouldn't because they respected the territorial integrity of Ukraine. And the Istanbul communique reflects this respect. Zaporizhia and Kherson would have gone back to Ukraine. All the territories that Russia had occupied around Kyiv, Sumy, etc., were going to be returned to Ukraine. So Jake Sullivan is just lying. The only reason why Russia went down the path that led it to the absorption of Novaya Russia, the four new territories, is because the West rejected the Istanbul communique. And the Ukrainian government doubled down on continuing their policy of cultural and ethnic genocide against the ethnic Russians of Ukraine. And so Vladimir Putin, a Russian leader who in 2005 told the Russian Federal Assembly that, he is the leader of the Russian nation, not just the Russian Federation, the Russian nation. And the Russian nation is comprised of people that have, the same history, the same culture, the same language, the same religion, shared values. And the ethnic Russians of Ukraine are part of the Russian nation. And now the Ukrainian government, with the backing of the West, said, we're going to allow the cultural genocide to take place, the erasing of their Russian identity. And so Putin stepped in and he's absorbed those territories as part of his plan of protecting them. And I can guarantee you that if this war continues, he will likely absorb more territories, not because that was the initial Russian objective. Jake Sullivan knows that that's a lie. He knows what the Russians wanted. But it's because it's, required, as long as you have this insane ultra-nationalist driven Ukrainian government sustaining policies of ethnic genocide, cultural genocide of Russians. So, Sullivan's wrong on that. So it wasn't about, territorial acquisition. The destruction of Ukraine, look, the Russians were going to let Ukraine live intact. Not now. It's over. There will be no Ukrainian state when this is finished. And that's because of Jake Sullivan. Jake Sullivan is to blame. Joe Biden is to blame. Emmanuel Macron is to blame. Scholz is to blame. Anybody who talked about giving Ukraine extended range ammunition is to blame, because Russia has said right now, Putin said it the other day, we will have to build buffer zones. And the buffer zones are designed by the maximum range of Ukraine's, best, long range systems. And they will draw a line that ensures that those weapons, if fired from Ukrainian soil, can't hit Russian soil. And you've pretty much taken all of Ukraine off the map now because of the weapons we've provided Ukraine. We're providing them weapons to save them. No, you provided the weapons that guarantee there will be no Ukraine when this is done. And that's the reality. Jake Sullivan is just spinning this. Again, it's like the captain of the Titanic trying to come up with an excuse about, how that iceberg got there and tore a hole in the ship. It's because you're a bad captain. You made a number of bad decisions, but now he's going to blame, global warming, or he's going to blame a school of dolphins who influenced the flow. He's going to blame something that's nonsensical instead of taking responsibility for his own actions.
Lloyd Austin said Putin will not stop at Ukraine, but Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide them with weapons it needs. And Ukraine's survival is on the line, and all of our security is on the line. The question is this: to what extent the West is willing to risk a new war with Russia?
Let's look at NATO. We know that NATO believes that any nation that wants to join NATO, except Russia, when Russia offered, they said no. But any nation other than Russia that wants to join NATO should be allowed in. And that, that's Russia's drawn a line. They said no, Ukraine will never be allowed in. Georgia will never be allowed in. So for Russia to win, it means that NATO's open door policy has been checked. Checkmate. And that's a problem for NATO. The other thing is that NATO is an extension of, it's the military power extension of the European Union. And the European Union's about a unified Europe. If Ukraine is defeated, as it will be, it's a defeat for both NATO and Europe, the European Union. And you're going to start to see deep fractures developing within NATO and the European Union, and leads to their collapse. So in many ways, the Europeans are right. A defeat in Ukraine will be a defeat for Europe and NATO. Of course it will be, because they defined the war as that way. But Russia's not going to move into Poland or move into NATO unless NATO attacks first. NATO's preparing to attack first. Emmanuel Macron is preparing to send thousands of troops into Ukraine. Basically the precursor for up to 60,000 non-NATO NATO troops, meaning they come from NATO nations, but they're not going to call themselves NATO. But I can guarantee you this: if Russia stands back and allows these 2,000 troops to be deployed in non-frontline situations, there's the old analogy of the camel in the tent. If you let the camel stick his nose under the tent and you don't bash it away, the camel's coming in the tent and you can't stop it. If you let 2,000 French troops go into Ukraine and you don't bash them away, you'll end up with 60,000 European troops in Ukraine, and then NATO will transform that under an Article 4 excuse into a NATO protectorate, and now NATO has taken over Western Ukraine. Russia can't allow that to happen, or else they lose the conflict. So, you know, we're talking about a situation where NATO's getting ready to attack Russia, and if this thing goes south, because the French troops will be killed. Understand that. Everybody needs to understand that. Every French soldier that goes in there will either be dead, wounded, or taken prisoner, or compelled to retreat. That's the only way it ends. There will be no French victory. There will be no NATO victory. But if France suffers that defeat, then they have to protect this force. They'll probably seek to reinforce this force because France can't afford politically to retreat, so they have to double down on stupid. But if you can't protect it from within Ukraine, that means you'll have to project power from without Ukraine. Where's that power going to come from? From NATO. NATO just attacked Russia. Do you remember when Vladimir Putin said that we have no plans on attacking Poland? Unless Poland attacks us. We're creating the conditions where Poland is going to attack Russia. Romania is going to attack Russia. And don't be surprised when Russia counterattacks and we find ourselves in a nuclear conflict and the entire European continent is destroyed, because that's what will happen. That is a guaranteed outcome. There's no other outcome from that scenario. So that's the direction we're heading. If Europe wants to commit suicide, so be it. I mean, it's a shame. I sort of enjoyed going on vacation in Europe. I did like the city of Rome. I did like London. I did like Paris. I liked Brussels. They'll all be gone because of the stupidity of Emmanuel Macron.
There is an article in the Washington Post says that there are Ukrainian villages with no men left. And at the same time, we see the Polish general Raymond Adzerzhak, I don't know how to pronounce his name. He says that the losses of the Ukrainian army in this conflict should be counted in millions, not hundreds of thousands. Do you think he's exaggerating in terms of the casualty on the part of Ukrainian, or he's reporting on the reality of the issue?
He's reporting on the reality of the issue. I've been saying this all along. People have been, no. I've been telling you. I've been counting the casualties. You're one of the people. Scott, that sounds a little high. How can you back it up? Military math. Today, I think it's accepted by most people that at least 500,000 Ukrainian soldiers have died. But when you count in the missing and stuff, that number could climb to 750,000, 750,000. Now, when you take a look at the battlefield statistics, you're looking at normally a dead to wounded ratio of at least 2-1, but probably 3-1. All right. So if we say 500,000 dead Ukrainians, that means a minimum of 1 million wounded Ukrainians, or 1.5 million. That's 2 million right there. We say 750,000, you know, we're getting up over 3 million. The Polish general is 100% correct. Or millions of Ukrainians soldiers have been casualties in this war. Doesn't mean they're dead, but it means that millions have been taken off the battlefield. When Ukraine started this conflict, we were talking about, you know, 250,000 active duty troops, another 700,000 reserves, territorialists, etc., to a force that was probably just under 1 million strong. Three times that many have been taken off the battlefield. This is the reality of this war. This is the reality of this war.
Lindsey Graham is talking about changing the law in Ukraine to send younger people to this conflict. Do you think that would change the game in Ukraine? And the other question would be, who's going to take these people accountable for what they're doing right now, for putting out statements that doesn't fit with the reality on the battleground in Ukraine?
I don't know who's going to hold them to account. You know, I'd like to believe that people with a moral conscience would. First of all, by ignoring them and not paying any attention to them, don't platform them. And second of all, to bring them to justice. And I'll let people decide how you bring them to justice. I mean, hopefully they have a system of justice they have confidence in, so that these people can be arrested and tried in accordance with the rule of law and punished accordingly. But we all know what happens when people lose confidence in the justice system. Vigilantism takes place. I'm not a big fan of it, but you know, you put yourself at risk when you behave in a manner like Lindsey Graham and others. And you create the need and necessity for vigilantism, because otherwise there will be no justice. He's a criminal. straight up criminal. And the vast majority of the people that articulate policy solutions that are similar to what he does are likewise criminal and must be held accountable for. Otherwise, they're just going to continue their criminal acts. And, even if only a certain percentage of their policy options are enacted, Lindsey Graham was a fervent supporter of this conflict. He's responsible for 3 million Ukrainian casualties. How does he be held accountable to that? How many life sentences must he serve? I just hope that Europe is listening to an American senator who's talking about Europe and talking gleefully about the need for Europe to sacrifice a generation of its manhood for an American senator's geopolitical wet dream. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
The head of Russian intelligence says that France is willing to send 2,000 military personnel to Ukraine. At the same time, we heard the same thing coming out of the French media. When Victoria Nuland was there and everybody was talking, she's pushing this idea of sending troops to Ukraine. Now she's gone. And who's driving the show? Who's running the show, in your opinion, right now?
Europe is responsible. No one's pushing Europe. Europe found itself in a very difficult position. They had leaned forward, expecting America to be alongside them the whole time. America has pulled back because of domestic political realities related to the upcoming presidential election, and then those realities have led to a holding the $60+ billion support package of Ukraine being held hostage, and they're not going to be released because it gives the Republicans leverage over border security issues and money, therefore derived. And the Republicans just aren't going to give this one up. And so Macron is leading forward. Macron wants to be the leader of France. He wants to be the leader of Europe. And he thought he could do so with America's backing. But now he realizes that if he backs down, blaming America isn't enough. He's going to be called a weak leader. So he's trying to look strong. Posture strong, and the rest of Europe's trying to look strong with him. No one's pushing them into stupidity. It's their own inherent, hubris and arrogance and ignorance that's causing this to happen.
The other thing that they're talking about is frozen Russian assets recently. They're talking about sending these assets to Ukraine. In your opinion, at the end of the day, would they do that, or they're talking about it?
If they didn't believe there would be consequences that would be extraordinarily detrimental to their economic health, long term and short term, they would do it. So what they're doing instead is they're seizing the interest money. I mean, $300 billion in banks it makes a lot of interest, and I think there's, a significant chunk of money that that has emerged. So they're taking that. I think Scholz, the German chancellor, today just said that. Taking the interest rates, it doesn't belong, taking the interest that's accumulated, that doesn't inherently belong to Russia, therefore it's not theft. No, it's theft. It's theft. If you had a bank account, an interest-bearing bank account, and I went to the bank and said, it's a holdup, but all I want is the interest that accrued from his account. Don't touch the principal. Do you think the bank would say, oh, that's not robbery. Here, let's give it to you. No, it's robbery. You're taking money that's not yours. Those Russian assets are deposited by law. They generate interest, and that interest belongs to Russia. And to take that, it's theft. And there will be consequences. One, the whole world's looking at this, and they have to make a decision. Is if we continue to participate in this situation, there may come a time when people turn on us and take our money. This is unhealthy. The other thing is retaliation. The Russians aren't just going to sit here and take this. I mean, the nations that start, stealing Russian assets may find that some of the hundreds of billions of dollars of assets that remain frozen in Russia because of the conflict will just be taken over by the Russians as, a way of compensating themselves for the losses that have taken place.
We see these differences between the Ukrainian foreign minister and Zelensky. And on the other hand, the brother of mayor of Kiev was talking about if we can replace Zelensky when we are at war with Russia, of course we can replace Zelensky as well. Do you think, with all that said, is that possible to see some sort of changes in Ukraine, or Washington is controlling everything there?
I mean, Washington influences everything, but clearly they don't control everything, or else there wouldn't have been a crisis of confidence between Zelensky and Zelensky. I think that there will be change in Ukraine. It won't be democratic in nature. It would be more linked to a military coup d'etat or a military coup in conjunction with political opposition. But either way, I think Zelensky is a failed leader and is growing, you know, is not so gradually being recognized both inside Ukraine and around the world as a failed leader. He is the problem, not the solution. And I think you're going to see Zelensky removed from power.
In Germany, despite having Olaf Scholz talking about getting more involved in the war in Ukraine, we have the leader of Alternative for Germany. He says that he is willing to repair the Nord Stream pipeline and put it into operation. Do you think that this party is going to be the next party in power in Germany?
We'll see. I don't think so. I mean, I'd like that. I'd love that kind of policy, but I think it would be inherently stabilizing for all parties involved. But democracy isn't Germany's strongest suit. It's a nation that's that governs by fear, intimidation. I think you'll find that you know there is a party who has been given the. You know, has been tapped to be the future of Germany, and they're going to work to make sure they stay in power. And they stay in power by appeasing the United States. They stay in power by continuing to promote the dream of a unified Europe. They don't stay in power by doing what's right for the German people. The best thing that could happen to the German economy is to turn, you know, there were four Nord Stream pipelines. Three of them were destroyed or damaged. There's one that's still open. It could be open today. Open that up, repair the other ones, get the oil flowing in, preserve as much of the European or the German industrial base as possible. But that's not the direction they're heading, no.
Do you understand why Sweden is getting more and more involved in this conflict? Why they're doing this? What's the main goal?
Well, I mean, they joined NATO, and so now as the junior member of NATO, they, of course, want to make everybody believe that they're willing to pull their own weight. So that's what's behind it. It's simple as that. They aren't thinking through the consequences. They don't realize that by empowering people to believe that more military force is the solution, not less, they're creating the conditions for the scenario that was described earlier, 60,000 non-NATO NATO forces deployed into Western Ukraine and in open conflict with the Russians. And then Sweden will find out the hard way what it means to be a member of NATO. They'll be destroyed as a nation state. So, you know, that seems to be what's behind it. Simple appeasement. Sweden is like the junior member of a team who's trying to be seen. Me, I can help. You know, when you join a team, you want to be a member, you know, you're like, anything I can do, I can stay after, I can buff the floors, I can get you coffee in the morning. I want to make myself valuable. And that's what Sweden is. It's a pathetic little juvenile act by a nation that long ago lost its ability to think and operate as a sovereign state.
It seems that the Biden administration still thinking of continuing this war. And do you see it's a political move on the part of the Biden administration? And when this presidential election 2024 is over, they're going to change their attitude, or they're going to, if they stay in power, they're going to have the same attitude toward Russia?
I think right now you have a policy that's predicated on using Ukraine as a tool to weaken Russia. Russia's in the process of destroying that tool. And if that was the only tool you had to accomplish the job and you suddenly find yourself toolless, you might have to reevaluate your approach. You want to chop down a tree, you got an axe. Axe breaks. Suddenly you're going to look at the tree and say, maybe I'll just use it for shade because the tree's there. It ain't going away. Plus, there's other things going on. We have BRICS. We have de-dollarization. We have, you know, a changing global environment. I think the Biden administration understands that they're running out of time on Ukraine, and they say if we lose, I say when they lose, and they are going to lose. It's a matter of mitigating the consequences of defeat. Can you get a better deal coming out? Can you negotiate something that preserves, a modicum of dignity and pride? Because that's what this is about. This is about politics. I firmly believe that the Biden administration does not want Ukraine on the ballot in November. So what does that mean? Do you think the Biden administration could turn this war around by November and declare victory? That's the answer. Shake your head no, because that's the answer. They're not going to do that. So they need this war to be over by November. There's the answer we want. And they're not going to win. We know they're not going to win. So it's just a matter of defining how they're going to lose. And that's where we're at with the Biden administration. But it's also a political game. They want to mitigate. So the posturing you're seeing from the Biden administration isn't necessarily because they believe they're going to get the money out of Congress and change the thing. It's because they're looking for a scapegoat. So they're calling the situation in Ukraine dire, and they're saying if this doesn't happen, a dire situation will occur. Knowing that it's not going to happen and the situation isn't that dire, but creating the opportunity to say it's the Republicans' fault. So the Biden administration isn't distancing itself too far from its original policy objectives of undermining Russia, destroying Russia, etc. But they want people to believe that they were serious about this, knowing that it's going to fail, and trying their best to deflect the blame for that failure on the Republicans. And that's what's happening. It's a stupid political game because we're in the silly season of American presidential politics.
One of our audience wanted me to ask you, how do you see the future of these small Baltic states, Finland, Sweden, with what's happening right now in Ukraine? How do you see the fate of these countries?
If Europe is smart and they can get an off-ramp that ends the conflict in Ukraine by basically giving up Ukraine, Russia is not going anywhere. They're not going to attack anybody. But if Europe creates the conditions where they try to put a 60,000 strong NATO force into Western Ukraine, then protected with Article 4 protections, and they get in a shooting match with Russia, the Baltic states will cease to exist. Finland will lose its capital city of Helsinki and significant territories because Russia is going to protect St. Petersburg, and Sweden will lose Gotland Island. There's your new reality. And that's what will happen, because NATO can't beat Russia. And if NATO wants to put nuclear forces on the table, then Europe will cease to exist. So everybody, Russia will not attack Europe. They will not initiate this attack. But if NATO attacks Russia, there will be no independent Baltic states. Poland will lose significant territory. Romania will lose territory. Finland will lose territory. Sweden will lose territory. That's the reality. Finland may even cease to exist. Hope the Finns enjoy that, returning back to Russian control. You had a chance, Finland. Finland has to understand that, Russia gave them a gift in 1945, the gift of life. But the gift of life, because remember, Finland joined Nazi Germany to fight the Russians. Finland's responsible for a million deaths in St. Petersburg. Finland should have been put to the sword, eliminated, and nobody would have blinked an eye. Nobody would have stepped up to defend Finland. But Russia said, no, Finland can exist. The Soviet Union said it, but it was predicated on permanent neutrality. Finland has opted out of neutrality. So if Finland wants to become part of a NATO-driven war of aggression against Russia, I would be surprised if Russia allowed Finland to continue to exist. I wouldn't if I were the Russian leadership.
One of the questions that comes to everybody's mind, that Finland was one of the countries that survived the Cold War. It's unbelievable how they decided to join NATO. And do you think they were forced to join NATO, or they decided by themselves?
I think Finland made a decision that neutrality they got arrogant and they believed that Russia was no longer in a position to challenge any deviation in their neutrality posture. And you have a segment of Finnish society that believes that they belong both feet firmly in the West to continue to exist as a neutral nation, especially at a time when Europe was divorcing itself and Russia was divorcing itself from Europe and vice versa. Finland didn't want to be like that battered child stuck in the middle of a bitter custody battle and a divorce. And so Finland picked a side. They chose that they want to be part of Europe, which means they need to be part of NATO. And they made the decision on their own volition.
In your opinion, if Trump wins, he's going to be able to distance Russia from China, or making this partnership weaker? How do you see the future if Trump wins?
Trump's not going to be able to weaken the ties between Russia and China. He may want to, he may think he can, but he won't. The thing about Donald Trump, he has to understand that his term, his first term, if he gets reelected, but his time in office was marked by unpredictability and instability. Yeah, the U.S. markets succeeded to an extent. I know that my 401k was looking pretty good under Trump, not looking good today under Biden. But, other than that, this was a man. Anatoly Antonov is the Russian ambassador to the United States, and I just had lunch with him. His favorite word is predictability. From a diplomatic standpoint, he says what he seeks above all else is predictability. Because then when you know what's going to happen, you can craft the appropriate policies. You might prefer this happens, but if it doesn't, at least you know what you need to do in response. Predictability. Donald Trump is the epitome of unpredictability. And so that means that the world is going to be very inefficient, very chaotic. The Chinese base their model of interaction with the world on the economy. Economies flourish with predictability because you can make long-term business plans, you can make investments, and you can anticipate outcomes. Economies flounder with chaos and unpredictability. So is Trump going to go to the Chinese and offer them what? Chaos, anarchy, unpredictability? No, predictability. But to do that, Trump would have to turn his back on those who got him elected. Trump's not going to do anything regarding China and Russia. Nothing. He doesn't have the intellectual capability to envision how to do it responsibly. He doesn't have the political support to get away with it. And he doesn't have the moral, fortitude to act on his convictions. He acts on very shallow political interests. That's it.
Do you remember when Vivek Ramaswamy said that if Taiwan is not ours, we can destroy Taiwan? How much of this is the official policy? I'm talking about the policy of elites, the blob in the United States.
Well, first of all, you have to understand that this gentleman has no military experience, no experience at all. He invested in a biotech, I guess, or pharmaceutical, and lied and made a lot of money, and that's it. So he's an unethical businessman. So when he talks about bombing, first of all, he's never received a military briefing from the Pentagon. So he doesn't know what the Pentagon's plan is. So for him to sit there and speculate about bombing, that's purely a construct in his sick imagination. It may be reflective of other thinking because people, applauded and supported him, but he didn't get enough support to stay in the election. So, he's a minority, he's a minority opinion on this, and it's based upon ignorance. That doesn't mean that in a war we wouldn't bomb those chip factories, but, I would imagine that that would be more of a collateral consequence of conflict as opposed to the principal consequence. So we're not going to war in Taiwan over computer chips. It's a broader issue than that. Computer chips are important, but we're not going to war. If we go to war or over Taiwan with China, it won't be about computer chips. First of all, Why would he bomb them? Because he wants to deny the access to of China to that technology. Too late. By sanctioning China and trying to shut the door, China's already overcome many of those hurdles, and they will overcome it in the future. So by bombing the factories, if you think you're harming China, you're not. You're just denying, you know, the global supply chain, which China has learned to live, to dominate in other ways. It's just, I think it's an extraordinarily stupid, you know, policy stance. And the fact that many Americans support it and continue to support it just shows you, you know, what kind of nation we've become, where we think it's good to bomb factories, to deny their people, bomb factories of nations that aren't our enemies, to deny people jobs simply because we're afraid of a certain technological capability. How weak do we have to be as a nation to be afraid of China gaining access to certain kinds of computer chips? How weak do we have to be willing to say, we'll go to war with that, we'll drop bombs, we'll kill tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of innocent civilians to protect the chip market? Any nation that embraces a policy of that nature is a nation that's not worthy of support.